It's an age-old question. Why do human beings have inherent weaknesses and shortcomings? Let me list just a few. Greed, stubbornness, short-sightedness, selfishness, being overly critical, closed-minded, vengeful, lust, gluttony, vanity, envy, destroying the natural environment, devaluing those who are different from us, militarism, racism, tribalism, slaveholding. Yep, we've got a few. Whatever weaknesses we as human beings may have, we've always wondered why they exist in ourselves and in others, and what we can do to overcome them. Humanity has written books and plays and poetry about our personal and societal shortcomings. We discuss them as psychological phenomenon and personal shortcomings, but also as moral issues and spiritual matters. And they are all of those. Today we're going to focus on a few of them: envy and the closely related companion characteristics of jealousy and schadenfreude. Depending on how much we allow these characteristics to take hold in ourselves, they can be substantial problems in our lives. So humanity has been concerned about envy for millennia. Being as we're here in church, I'd like to explore in what ways it's considered to be a moral and spiritual issue. Well, first, it's listed prominently in the Ten Commandments. The first half of the commandments are all about believing in the Hebrew God. But the second half of the commandments tend to deal with ethical matters: honoring parents, not killing others, being faithful, not stealing, not lying. And the last two commandments are about envy. They say that we should not covet the neighbor's house, nor the neighbor's wife, nor the neighbor's servants, animals, or anything else. Fast forward 1,000 years or so. In the 3rd century, a monk in the Egyptian desert warned of a number of specific shortcomings that people should focus on overcoming in their lives. Pope Gregory distilled those items down into the list of 7 deadly sins. Envy was listed as one of those sins. Envy's everywhere in literature. Shakespeare described it as the green-eyed monster in Othello, a play where jealousy results in tragic consequences. So why does envy exist? Envy is an ugly, miserable, unflattering emotion. I suppose we should all admit at the beginning of this discussion that it's widespread. It may not be a problem with everyone, but it's probably there under the surface to some degree in certain circumstances. Most people, at some time or other, will experience the feeling of wanting what someone else has or resenting them for having it. To me, one of the primary reasons it's around is simply evolution. Natural selection sends on to the next generation not what is moral and ethical, but what is adaptive for survival. Sure, cooperation and our social context has been crucial for the survival of our species. But those who were highly competitive, who just had to come out ahead, they were the ones that tended to pass their genes into the future generation. And voila, those tendencies are passed along. I'm reading a book right now about the many physical design flaws in the human body. It may seem a mystery as to why some of those defects in the design of bodies are like they are, but the reason for them is usually found in how evolution works. On the physical level, certain traits are selected for. And even if those traits aren't perfect, if they're more survivable than those without the traits, they become the more prevalent in the next generation. And even with imperfections, there's no mechanism within natural selection to undo traits that have been selected in past generations. So those traits continue on. Well, to some degree, the same is true for personality characteristics. There were those who compared themselves against others, who really hated that others may have been above them in one manner or other, and who found ways to bring themselves up or bring the other people down. If it helped them to survive, then they passed along that trait. Those of us living today have remnants of all those past sins. Some of those traits may have been despicable, but we inherited any trait that resulted in those ancestors surviving. We inherit their physical traits, and we inherit their personality characteristics, too. When we look at another characteristic, over-the-top tribalism and the historic cruelty of some religions, we can see that to a large part it may stem from the same cause. We evolved as troop animals on the savanna. The accumulation of culture led to tribes, each with its own set of things that were worshipped and things that were taboo. It's nearly ubiquitous that the members of a tribe referred to themselves exclusively as the people, implying that everyone else was fair game for forcibly converting or wiping out, because members of other tribes were seen as inferior or at least as competition to your tribe. Maybe they were even considered to be subhuman. I want to mention that for some of my examples today, I'm borrowing heavily from an NPR podcast called Hidden Brain. It's a podcast that discusses the unconscious patterns that drive human behavior. One of the episodes was about envy, and listening to that podcast what sparked the idea in my head to talk about this. So let's talk about emotions in general. It's hard to imagine life without the pleasure of happiness or the pain of sadness. These emotions help to make us whole. They give us a way to understand life in all its beauty and suffering. But an emotion like envy seems different. It feels repugnant and useless. That said, there may be positive sides to envy, or at least a neutral side to it. I'm stretching to describe envy in non-negative terms, but here's what I came up with. First, we make sense of the world through social comparison. A researcher at Harvard pointed out that when you meet a new person, there are a lot of things about them that you register immediately. But you don't just register them in some abstract or absolute sense. You register them relative to yourself. So not just how tall is this person, but how much taller or shorter are they than I am? We do this because the comparison tells us where we fit in, what our place is in human hierarchy. What's more, it alerts us to imbalances that might need our attention. Sometimes the comparisons we make might be motivating. If someone has a talent, we admire them. If someone has more than what we have, we may be inspired by what they have. So we may experience these benign forms of envy, which could also manifest as admiration or motivation. One could see it also as being a motivating force for working harder, getting ahead, providing your family with more. At other times, it can be disabling and even can tear apart friendships. In 2014, Jessica Kyle and her best friend traveled to the remote Karamos Islands in the Indian Ocean. They were there to teach English. It was meant to be a grand adventure, and it could have been a high point of their friendship, except that Jessica and her friend got sick with dengue fever. Jessica was single while her friend was married to a doctor. Her friend's husband was worried about her and was able to get her evacuated to Kenya, to a hospital with air conditioning, good food, and excellent medical care. Jessica, meanwhile, was stuck on the island where it was about 100 degrees and there was no electricity. Jessica was extremely envious of her friend to the point where it was actually physically painful. Other than just having dengue fever, she reported that the envy she felt because of wanting to be in her friend's place and the feeling of abandonment was physically painful. Jessica did eventually recover, as did her friend, and when they were reunited, Jessica found it difficult to remain friends. Eventually, she told her friend about the pain of being abandoned. It took many conversations with her friend, Jessica explaining how much she was hurt by that, knowing that it was not her friend's fault, but still needing to get those feelings out there. They are now best friends again. Jessica reports that she did get over it eventually, but it was really, really hard. The more hostile forms of envy have to do with leveling the playing field, not by bringing me up to where you are, but bringing you up down to where I am. And it's interesting to note that some of the most virulent forms of envy are reserved for people who are in the same boat as us. I'm not going to compare my salary to, say, Warren Buffett's, but it's likely I could compare it to someone who does the same kind or amount of work that I do but might be making more money. Taken a few steps further, envy can turn into jealousy, tribalism, and schadenfreude. For anyone who might not know the term, schadenfreude is defined as taking pleasure from another person's misfortune. As a humorous illustration, let's talk about The Simpsons television show. Homer's an excellent example of pretty much all of the deadly sins. He's lazy, gluttonous, he's greedy, and Homer's always also consumed with envy, especially of his good do-gooder neighbor, Ned Flanders. Homer can't stand Flanders. Why? Well, Flanders is a pillar of the community. He's got a nicer house, a fancier grill, a better job. Usually, Homer's left to stew in his own bile, but in one episode, Flanders does something unusual. He announces he's quitting his job to open the Leftorium, a store with gadgets for left-handed people. Finally, Homer feels he has the upper hand. The Leftorium, he believes, is a really stupid idea. Homer dreams that it will finally lead to Flanders' downfall. One day, Homer goes to spy on the store and sees that nobody's in it. He goes home and crows in glowing terms about Flanders' store being deserted. As a less fictional, real-world example of schadenfreude, let's look at the sports world. Researchers at University of Kentucky put together a study on the basketball rivalry between the Kentucky Wildcats and the Duke Blue Devils. These teams are rivals just about every year. So obviously, Kentucky fans are glad when the Blue Devils lose. But what researchers wanted to know was whether the rivalry led to more sinister places. So they asked University of Kentucky students to respond anonymously to an article describing a serious injury to the star player on the rival Duke team. What they found is that students who didn't care about basketball felt no schadenfreude. They felt considerable sympathy for the injured player. On the other hand, hardcore Kentucky fans had an entirely different reaction. They were quite happy when the rival player for the opposing team got seriously injured. I believe schadenfreude is tied in with dehumanization and then persecution of people who are different from us. Our UU principles tackle this head on. Our first principle is to affirm the inherent worth and dignity of all people. It doesn't say people who are like us. It says all people. But we are currently encountering an epidemic of those, and let me just come out and say that I'm referring to the president and his followers, who seek on a national scale to dehumanize immigrants, Muslims, and other groups, and who seem to take pleasure in putting them down. Once we dehumanize a group, it's easier to oppress them. So, what can happen when it occurs on a societal level? The results can be disastrous. Was this same kind of dehumanization one of the underlying triggers of the Holocaust? People wonder how the Holocaust could ever have happened. How was it that the German people allowed it to occur? Well, the suffering of Jews in the 1930s and 1940s came after a time of Jewish prosperity when the average Germans were struggling financially. Envy was then spurred on by Nazi propaganda. Along the way, of course, Nazis did various things before they engineered concentration camps and mass murder. But anytime Jews suffered in any way, often because of the things the Nazis did deliberately to engineer it, normal Germans tended to feel a little more accepting of it because of them having been dehumanized. I worry that today the same process may be setting the stage for a similar disaster using the same mechanism. Is today's dehumanization going to lower Americans' resistance to something similar happening here? Now, I want to point out that I do not think that we are all just seething bags of envy, jealousy, and schadenfreude. But when any of our built-in shortcomings and weaknesses crop up, either in ourselves or in others, I think we all struggle with understanding them. So, what can we do about all this? Well, I could go many directions on this, and many people have throughout the millennia. We could delve into the philosophy to realize that there will always be someone who's ahead of us, or talk about sensitivity training to protect us against dehumanizing others, or getting into realizing the need and comfort for each of us to find satisfaction in living in our own shoes. We can talk about the importance of understanding that we are each enough, of being gratified with what we've got, of enjoying our one feather. I don't think we're going to solve it today, if millennia of pondering has not. But I'm going to go another direction and point out a couple of other ideas. Earlier, we heard the story of Jessica Kyle and dengue fever. Her envy was so intense that she said it caused her physical pain. It very well might have led to the end of a long friendship, but that didn't happen. And the reason it didn't happen is Jessica brought her envy into the light of day. She exposed it fully, talked about what she had been feeling, and that simple act, admitting to something that many people would have kept locked inside, allowed her to triumph in this situation. Perhaps as a lesson in Jessica's story, the first step is to fight envy is to simply admit that it's there and name it. Of course, as another step, we always need to remember and reinforce the fact that there is so much goodness in people. That's not a difficult thing. So to give the opposites of some of the lists that I gave earlier, people are full of generosity, love, caring for family and friends, striving to make the world a better place, working for the security of those they love, long-sighted, supportive, charitable, and so much more. I think it's important to surround ourselves in positivity, not in a naive way, but in a realistic way. Surrounding ourselves with a supportive and caring spiritual faith group like Unitarian Universalism is constructive. Doing positive things in our life is important. As we say at the end of our service, we always try to be a light unto the world. And then in a wider view, my sense is that when we do slip, the first step is to simply recognize that these emotions exist and why. To a large degree, it's part of the human condition. Be aware of how these things came about in human species, that everyone is human and may be struggling with them to some degree or other. Realize that human personality shortcomings are there because they helped in our distant ancestors in outcompeting others. Okay, they were passed along to us, but we don't need to let them get a hold of us. If we're momentarily pulled into such a negative place, being aware of this could help us realize that we might be feeling this way more because of what's hardwired into us than because of some transgression on the part of the other person or group. I'd like to read you something written by Pema Chodron, an American Tibetan Buddhist, who wrote a book titled How Not to Be Jealous. About overcoming these things, she writes, "The first step is to see yourself jealous, see yourself frivolous, see yourself wallowing in self-pity. You think to yourself, well, what would Dr. Seuss do in this situation? Instead of using it as ammunition against yourself, you can lighten up and realize that that information is what you needed in order to keep your heart open." Close quote. Later, she likens these emotions to habits and addictions. My own take on what she's saying is that we need to realize that things like envy, jealousy, and schadenfreude, and many of our built-in imperfections and shortcomings may simply be reflexive in us to some degree. We are all the result of natural selection, of genes that got passed on to us by those ancestors who survived. And natural selection does not care what's moral or how we wish we could be. Armed with this knowledge, we can now understand that we are the ones who can then decide whether we're going to allow them to take hold or recede. I'd like to end this message with a unison reading and take the unusual step of asking you to open your gray hymnal to reading 477. That's reading 477 in your gray hymnal. While you're finding it, I'll tell you that the author, Reverend Vivian Pomeroy, was a minister at a Unitarian church in Massachusetts from the 1920s until the 1950s. To me, this is a prayer asking for forgiveness for when we put people down who are different from us, for times when religions have tried to forcibly convert or coerce others, for times when we may have dehumanized others because we regarded ourselves as being morally superior. Let's read his prayer together in unison. Please join me. Forgive us, for often we forgive others so easily and others so hardly. Forgive us that we expect perfection from those to whom we show none. Forgive us for repelling people by the way we set a good example. Forgive us the folly of trying to improve a friend. Forbid that we should use our little idea of goodness as a spear to wound those who are different. Forbid that we should feel superior to others when we are only more shielded. And may we encourage the secret struggle of every person. Amen, and so be it.